Hello, everyone. Welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Paul Taylor, the president of Evolving Wisdom, one of the organizations producing this event. And today, we'll be continuing this deep exploration of the future of spiritual practice with Integral Enlightenment founder, Craig Hamilton. Terry Patton is the visionary behind this groundbreaking series and online community, and our host for our call today. Terry is a leading voice in the fields of integral evolutionary practice, leadership, and spirituality, who coaches, challenges, supports, and connects evolutionaries all over the world. He's the author with Ken Wilber of Integral Life Practice. Warm welcome to you, Terry.
Thank you, Paul. And hi, everybody. Welcome. As you know, I convened this series to serve a deepening public education and public conversation about the evolution of consciousness and culture. By asking the question, how can our spirituality play a key role in helping us rise to the challenges of our time and transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet? We've had a series of adventuresome, probing, and enlivening conversations in which we've focused on many specific aspects of this question. And this morning, I'm really happy to be joined in conversation by Craig Hamilton in a dialogue entitled Integral Enlightenment, Embodying the Impulse to Evolve. Craig Hamilton is a real pioneer in the emerging field of evolutionary spirituality. In all his work, including writings, talks, and teachings, he calls on people to awaken beyond the confines of the separate ego and dedicate our lives to the further evolution of consciousness and culture. He is the founder and guiding force behind Integral Enlightenment, and in that role, he offers spiritual guidance and teachings now to a growing international community of thousands of students in 30 countries around the world. This is all done through his online Academy for Evolutionaries, where he teaches a series of experiential telecourses that guide participants through a process of spiritual awakening into an evolutionary relationship to life. His work at Integral Enlightenment integrates decades of intensive spiritual practice with insights gleaned during his 8 years as the senior editor of the award-winning What is Enlightenment magazine. For 13 years, he participated in the dynamic living laboratory of evolution known as Enlightened Next, where he played a key role in the leadership of that thriving international spiritual community. And in his current work, he's helping to articulate an authentic evolutionary spirituality, an integral enlightenment that illuminates the vital relationship between individual transformation and collective evolution. He is a founding member of Ken Wilber's Integral Institute, a member of Deepak Chopra's Evolutionary Leaders Forum, and was a participant in the Synthesis Dialogues, a 35-person interdisciplinary think tank presided over by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. His celebrated conversations with other luminaries form the basis of the acclaimed webinar series, The Great Integral Awakening and Awakening the Impulse to Evolve. He has also been a contributor to Shift magazine and co-authored the Institute of Noetic Sciences' 2008 Shift Report. Craig lives with his wife, Claire, in San Rafael, California. And one of the things that I particularly love about Craig, he's also a personal friend and a kind of an inspiring leader. He is truly someone who, although he's a deeply feeling and receptive person, he really has made his life a stand for transcending limits. And he tolerates discomfort with good humor and really stands in a kind of clarity that is deeply human, even as it is a kind of a clarion call for going beyond what we ordinarily think are our limits. And it's a big part of what I love about him. So welcome, Craig. It's really great to have you with me in a dialogue in this series, which has gotten so rich, and maybe it's ready for us to take it to the next level.
Well, hey, Terry, thank you very much for the warm welcome, and I really appreciate all of it. And it's I was just reflecting before getting on this call that we started this series together. I interviewed you a little bit for your very first intro call for the series, and now I'm looking back on months of this and 34,000 people getting involved and just all the rich dialogues you've had. So I just want to take a moment to honor you and your leadership that's really been blazing a trail into a lot of deep and challenging questions. So I'm happy to be rejoining the dialogue.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you, Craig. You know, your dialogues were a big part of the inspiration for launching Beyond Awakening, and I think we've taken it into some new places. So, well, I want to plunge in because, as you know, everyone who's involved in Beyond Awakening, all the folks listening and I have had the privilege of engaging with many of the premier spiritual teachers and thought leaders of our time. And in some of those conversations, we have experienced powerful transmissions of consciousness and being, communications that are profound and go way beyond the mind, expressing an intuitive freedom and an awareness that's palpable and remarkable and profound. And yet, Craig, although I know you appreciate this deeply and regard it as kind of the foundation of the kind of work you're interested in doing, you're clearly somebody who says that this classical enlightenment and freedom is not enough. So it might be rich for you to explain, you know, what exactly is missing if you have that classical enlightenment without awakening to this evolutionary impulse, this impulse to evolve. What tends to happen?
Well, it's a really interesting question that you brought up. And, you know, it sets me up to be potentially in a provocative position of showing disrespect to thousands of years of tradition. So I'm going to make sure I do my best not to do that. But, you know, in a sense, see, you're talking about you called it classical enlightenment, and what you're really talking about here is the primordial awakening to being itself, or to consciousness itself, without modification, without object, pure consciousness, what you've often called radical consciousness, which is and has always been the essence of the what's been called enlightenment or self-realization or God-realization throughout the ages. And there are, as you said, many people today who are teaching that exact same traditional radical path to unconditional freedom, the particular unconditional freedom that's found when we discover being. And when, you know, in a sense, you think about the ordinary human condition where most of us are lost in egoic conditioned patterns, emotional reactivity, reacting in ways that we don't even understand, and then the prison that tends to create, the experience of being bound by conditional habits that we don't seem to have control over. And then one comes into this discovery of being and realizes, oh, wow, before all of it, I simply am. Before anything ever arose, there's just being. I can just be. None of the becoming even matters. None of the things I thought I had to be or become are important. I can just let go and be. And it's this, as you said, this ecstatic experience of liberation that can be born in that realization. And particularly, there's an experience in that of completeness, of finality, of nothing moreness. Like, what else could there ever be that could be added to this perfection of being? Nothing. And this is where, you know, traditionally, enlightenment has been seen as an end state, because once one realizes that, what else is there to do? You know, and we've often seen in that moment, traditionally sort of a walking away from the world in a sense, and just some of the great saints just simply sat there after that more or less and didn't do anything else except maybe sit there and talk a little bit. And because they were just so ecstatically overtaken with this extraordinary primordial freedom. And, And so, you know, it's a fair question to say, well, what could possibly be added to that, or what could possibly be more than that? Isn't that, as many of the great traditions have said, isn't that the final end of the spiritual path? Isn't that what all seeking is taking us toward, the realization that we never had to seek to begin with, because who we are in our essence is already free and full? So what I want to add to that, because see, let me just say that everything I just described, would still say, is the foundation of authentic spiritual life. It is still the foundational kind of ground, if you will, of any enlightenment, of any authentic awakening, needs to be rooted in that. And yet, what we're finding emerging right now, and I say right now, I mean it's been something that's emerging over, I would say, the last maybe couple hundred years, gradually coming into being and taking a particularly strong turn, you know, into manifestation, say over probably in the last maybe 75 years, with where Sri Aurobindo's work and the work of Teilhard de Chardin, and then, of course, later, the work of Andrew Cohen and many others today, myself included, yourself included, starting to really tap into a different face of divinity that is not just about being. And so if it's not all just about being, well, what is this other face of God? And, you know, I'll quote my own spiritual teacher who I spent many years with, Andrew Cohen, who said it's becoming. There's being and there's becoming. And those are the two different aspects of what he called evolutionary enlightenment, what I've come to call integral enlightenment. But it's really pointing to this same point, that for enlightenment to be integral, meaning for it to be whole, for it to contain and express itself through every aspect of our human condition and humanity, it has to be an enlightenment that is grounded in being, but is also an awakening to what we might call the spirit, with a capital S, the spirit of becoming, or the creative face of God, the evolutionary aspect of divinity. Because, of course, I'm tracing this back a couple hundred years, and people are probably wondering, well, what happened then? Well, what started to happen a couple hundred years ago was that human beings started to get that we were part of an evolving process, that we were part of an evolutionary process. It was, you know, perhaps began with the German idealists, who were starting to see history as progression, as the progression of the unfolding of divinity in the world. That in a sense we started to realize, oh, things are not just shifting around in random ways. There's actually a progression happening here. We're going somewhere. Of course, Darwin's Origin of Species really put that was the final straw that kind of broke that camel's back and really brought this into full awareness, at least in terms of biology, but which was only about 150, 160 years ago. And so here we are now, awakening to an evolutionary worldview, where we now can see that we're part of this vast cosmic unfolding process. And we see it's not just biology, it was happening there was cosmological evolution that began 13.7 billion years ago. Then there was the evolution of life. Then with the birth of self-reflective humans, there was the evolution of culture began. And we can see how culture has radically evolved since, even in the 35,000 years since, or 35 to 50,000 years since self-reflective humans came on the scene. And what we can also see now is that consciousness has evolved and is continuing to evolve dramatically. And so are we going to, in the face of this, you know, awakening to this, to the recognition of evolution, are we going to see that as samsara? To use the traditional term, are we going to see all of this extraordinary evolutionary unfolding as somehow less real than being itself? Some people take that position. In fact, many contemporary spiritual teachers who are focused primarily on being or being in the moment, this kind of teaching, will say, yeah, of course, what's really true and real is being, and this is all just some sort of shadow play on the surface or ripple on the surface of being. But I would say no, that's a complete misunderstanding of reality, and it's what I would call a partial spiritual realization, because it part and parcel with this emerging understanding of evolution, what's happening is that there's a new kind of spiritual awakening that's coming online, which is this awakening to the evolutionary principle itself as divinity, as God, and as a God that we can fully embody, that we can incarnate, if you will, and become the force of evolution itself in human form. And it's my feeling that when that kind of realization, this radical awakening to the spirit of becoming, which is pure creativity, its ecstasy and liberation is found in radical creative engagement with the life process itself. And there's a completely different order of spiritual liberation that comes from that kind of awakening. And so what I would call the complete or integral enlightenment is the one that includes both, where we can let go completely into being and discover the liberation that's found there, but that we don't then rest there or build a home there, but we're then able to ecstatically let go into awakening to the force of becoming, to the evolutionary impulse itself, and then allow that to become the driving force, the raison d'etre for our lives.
Beautifully. That was a very well-argued kind of laying out of the ground, and I resonate with much of it. It's interesting, though, the understanding of that and the resonation with that tends to be experienced more as a philosophy than a presence that is transmissive. And some people will feel that it isn't as deep, that it's the ego, the mind, engaging this from a place of disturbance, and that it lacks the deep peace that is so profoundly transmissive, the equanimity, the utter relaxation of the being, the acceptance and the transcendence of dilemma that is such a fragrant dimension of that being.
Yeah.
Realization. Is that somehow present in a tacit way, even in this experience of urgency?
Well, what you bring up, it's an interesting and great observation. It's one I've noticed a lot, too. And this is why in my own work at Integral Enlightenment, I put such a strong emphasis on both pieces. Because, you see, what's also happening today is that many people are awakening to this kind of evolutionary impulse, this kind of conscious evolution meme, if you will, that's awakening. But they're doing so in the absence of any kind of what we would call classical enlightenment kind of realization or deep mystical practice of being, you know, deep intensive meditation practice, for instance. They're doing it without that, and they're getting all lit up with evolution, and they're excited about evolution. You know, there are many teachers like this talking about evolution, and you can hear their inspiration. It's almost as though they're channeling some kind of cosmic energy, you know, coming through them as they get inspired and start talking about, you know, this awakening to becoming. But it's not grounded in that which is inherently beyond the mind, and so it ends up, as you said, being kind of an exciting philosophy that can really light people up, and it can be its own kind of spiritual experience too, but it can easily, as you said, get corrupted by the ego. And why? Because what's the ego all about? Becoming. The ego is all about becoming and wanting and needing and a sense of lack, and how do I fill that hole, that sense of lack, and I need to become more, I need to do more, I need to be more. And so this is where, you know, as you were kind of giving voice to, there are so many of the what we might call traditional or, you know, modern-day traditionalists or modern-day perennialists who are teaching pure being as the sole foundation and fruition of the path. That's why so many of them would see this kind of evolutionary piece on its own as, well, that must just be ego, because if you really had discovered being, how could you possibly be interested in becoming anything or creating anything or thinking anything needed to change? And again, what I would say is, well, okay, so sounds good. I mean, it's a convincing argument. And when you hear it from somebody who's really just resting in being, it'll have the transmission of being, which is, as you said, much easier to feel because it's such a powerful contrast to the egoic way of being, which is so frenetic and full of fear and lack and incompleteness and struggle, that kind of, when you hear somebody speaking from that place of deep and abiding peace, it's like light entering the darkness. There's a strong, stark contrast. But again, I'm going to say, this evolutionary awakening that I'm talking about, or this integral enlightenment, isn't it really in step with the times? Because you see, when a person was a serious spiritual practitioner, even a couple hundred years ago, but definitely throughout history, there was only one path for them typically, and it was to leave the world behind completely, go off into a cave or a monastery or an ashram, and devote their life wholeheartedly to the discovery of God or the holy life. And yet now, so many of us are awakening to this desire to really live an authentic spiritual life. I'm sure everybody who's listening to this call feels that, desire to live a deep, authentic spiritual life. And yet we don't necessarily feel called to leave the world behind. And why not? Because the world needs us. The world needs you and it needs me. Why? It needs us to help the process evolve. And, of course, right now we have this crisis, that so many people are pointing to, the sort of compounding global crises that I'm sure you've talked a lot about so far on, that I know you've talked a lot about so far in the series. But that's not the whole of it either. It's just now that we're starting to awaken to evolution itself, we're awakening to possibility, for a radically different world that we could create. Because we're realizing, oh, things aren't static, things aren't fixed, people aren't static. People, even the brain isn't static. The brain is plastic, human behavior is malleable, culture is malleable, and it's changing all the time. And wow, we now realize this and we could change it. It's in our hands to do. And when you start to discover that, the thought that you're going to just go leave the world and go enter the cave and just rest in being, it just feels so completely out of step with what we now know to be true about reality. That made a lot of sense in a worldview where you basically believed that this world was unredeemable, that the world was suffering, it was samsara, and the only salvation was in heaven or in nirvana, in somehow getting out of here, because this place could never be really improved. But now we know it can be improved, and it is being improved, and it can be improved not just on the exteriors, but the interior can be evolved. Meaning, and by that I mean what it's like to be Terry, what it's like to be Craig, what it's like to be a person can radically evolve into something glorious and beautiful and sacred and holy, and we can help each other do that, and the world can become heaven on earth. We now have that sense, that possibility. So we have to give to it. It's not going to happen if we're just sitting in being. There's no juice to do anything in being. You just want to be. I don't know if I quite answered your question.
No, that was beautiful. This whole issue of getting off the wheel or getting into life has been something that, it's a deep dimension of my teachings, and as you know, we're quite congruent on a lot of that. And yet there is I think we could go a level deeper into this paradox, because it is from that place of being that a kind of freedom from the superficial levels of consciousness is realized. And there is a paradox as you begin to feel this evolutionary commitment. You, in some sense, do descend into the cacophony of the content of the world and then are affected by it. The constant emails and interruptions and the jangly kind of quality of life, if you're in there pitching, trying to make a difference, on superficial levels, it seems as though you're descending back into the kind of distraction by content that is characterizing the pre-spiritual life. And the intuitive need to be free of that, how is that fulfilled in an evolutionary, fully committed, fully alive evolutionary life? I think people would really love to hear you unpack how that ecstatic freedom is experienced without a kind of detachment from the constant flow of urgent demands.
I don't know if this is quite answering what you're asking, but let me take a crack at it. So if we want to think, well, what is it that we really want to be free from? In other words, like, you know, or what is it that classical enlightenment really liberates us from? You know, sure, you could list many things like distractions and this and that. You know, those are maybe the things. In many ways, a lot of what you listed are the things our ego wants to be free from. Like, my ego kind of wants to be free from the complexity and the difficulty and the discomfort of life. The ego wants basically comfort. It wants to not feel pain and it wants to feel pleasure. And that's kind of primary orientation of the kind of primitive self that we all incarnate. But that's not really what enlightenment or liberation or even being ultimately really liberates us from. I mean, it might to some degree. But I would say if that's where the attention is, we're kind of missing the boat, because the deeper liberation, and this is true whether it's the classical liberation or what we're calling the evolutionary or integral awakening that we're talking about now, really the important freedom is freedom from wrong views. It's freedom from distorted perception. And what is it that distorts our, and why is that important? Because it's our distorted perception of the world that's right in front of us that leads to erroneous action, that leads to doing the wrong thing and creating karma, which means, you know, creating, you know, causing harm to others out of our own ignorance because we didn't see what was really going on. And what is it that distorts our perception? Well, the Buddha said it was fear and desire, more or less. You know, that's a translation, but that's kind of the classical notion, fear and desire. So what we really want to discover freedom from in any context is fear and desire. And that doesn't mean we want to never experience fear, and it doesn't mean we don't want to experience desire. We're not talking about, and that's often been a misunderstanding too. People think, oh, if you're truly enlightened, there's no fear would ever arise and no desire would ever arise. And I say, right, and that means they're just going to die in a few days because they're never going to drink water because they didn't desire water. So that's not really quite how it works. But the point is, we do want to discover a liberation from fear and desire, but it's a liberation in the face of fear and desire, meaning, here I am, this body-mind organism that's conditioned in all these manifold ways, and yet, what does it mean for me to discover who I am that's not conditioned by these primitive craving impulses and primitive fear reactions? In other words, I want to come to a place where, no matter how strong the fear is that arises, I'm not going to be a slave to it, meaning I'm not going to have to act on it. I'm not going to have to follow its bidding because I know it for what it is. I can see it for what it is. And I say, oh, okay, that's the arising of fear. Is it an appropriate fear or an inappropriate fear? Okay, I step out in the street and a car is about to hit me and I feel fear and I jump out of the way. Good fear to have. Let's never lose that one. Okay. My desire to take care of another person or to even take care of myself, my desire to feed myself and get enough rest and be healthy and be happy. Let's not lose that either. That's good in its basic essence. But again, when a strong desire arises, right now, for instance, you know, so there's so much scandal swirling around again these days about spiritual teachers, male spiritual teachers falling prey to primitive sexual impulses and sleeping around and ruining their teaching work, essentially. It's just happened again recently. And again, so when strong sexual desire arises, it's one of the most powerful desires we can feel. Am I standing free of it? Can I see what it is? Okay, there's strong sexual desire arising. Is it appropriate? Well, in this relational context with my partner and everything's good, it's maybe totally appropriate. In a context where I'm in a monogamous, committed relationship and the sexual desire is arising for someone else, it's probably not appropriate because I have an agreement here, you know, and et cetera. So, you know, I'm giving a rudimentary look at this, but this then, of course, just takes on increasing layers and layers of subtlety. When you really break the human experience apart, you find that we're essentially all the time being driven by kind of primordial fear, primordial desire, and we want to attain a place where we're able to stand free of it and choose freely in the face of it, such that it's not distorting our perception. It's not making us want it. We're not giving in to wanting that thing so bad that we're going to tell ourselves a story that it's a good idea to get it when it's not. So we're now able to do what the Buddha called right action. We're able to live a life of right action because we've attained right view and right motivation. Okay, so what I'm saying is, so you're kind of asking, well, how would that freedom come about in this evolutionary context? What is it that frees us from the world in that sense, from fear and desire in that sense? And so there are a couple different ways to talk about it, but one is that, you see, what we begin to discover when we begin to awaken to the evolutionary impulse as ourself, because that's really the higher point of this integral or evolutionary awakening, is when we begin to awaken not to the idea of evolution and not to excitement about participating in evolution, but we awaken as evolution. We awaken as the evolutionary God in first person, as ourself. And what we discover in that awakening is we discover a radically different motivation for being. We discover a radically different drive, and it radically reorients our priorities, our values, what's important to us. Because the thing that becomes important to us, and particularly if we really go into this, what ultimately becomes the only thing that's important to us, is that this divine order, if you will, this divine ordering principle, because in a sense that's what this evolutionary impulse is. It's an impulse toward higher orders of harmony, higher orders of unity, higher orders of integration. It's always wanting more of the good, the true, the beautiful. It's this never-ending upward pull and thrust that is a mystic. And when we discover it as ourself, when we awaken to it in its interior, we discover it's an ecstatic principle that is pulling us upward and is longing, kind of almost pleading for our unconditional surrender to it, for our radical participation in it, to where we let go of any other motive, of any other priority, of any other need, and that becomes our need is now the evolutionary need. Our drive is the evolutionary drive. When that awakening happens in a profound way in a person, the self completely changes. The small self with all of its self-conceived limitations and contractions is now seen as this tiny little thing. It's not that it goes away entirely. It's just this tiny little speck in this vast current of ecstatic becoming that's going somewhere, and that is an enormous yes, and we discover our liberation from ego, from contraction, from smallness, from limitation, from fear, from, you know, petty desire. It's all disintegrated in a sense in this unconditional yes to the spirit of becoming itself. And so now what happens, that this is the really true evolutionary mysticism, is we become a living incarnation of the force of evolution itself, which is, as I said, it's not a neutral force. It's an impulse toward good, toward the good, toward the true, toward the beautiful, toward higher orders of becoming whole. And so in that, you were saying it's maybe not as transmissive. It's not transmitting the same thing as being, but it is. It's actually, in my experience, it's actually more transmissive because it's such a powerful force. You know, it's not merely rest and just peace. It's this. It's the force of the universe. It's the Big Bang alive in you now. And you in that moment discover you're the leading edge of the Big Bang, or pretty darn close to it. You're right out there surfing the waves of the next evolutionary unfolding, and you want to give your whole life to that and that alone in every moment, in every circumstance, which then radically overrides all smaller drives, all smaller fears. And in that, you become kind of a radical, fearless force of evolution in the world. And a lot of people are going to hate you for doing it because you're going to be so intense. but the people who are feeling the call in that direction are going to be radically inspired by you.
It's beautiful that this expression, and these are ideas you and I have discussed many times, and yet in this round I find myself thinking about the changed relationship to personal experience that you're describing as being, well, everything you said just now certainly is true, and yet this isn't, we still need the vehicle of a life that works, and a personal, the personal isn't possible to completely transcend. There's still this vehicle of a body, mind, and identity, and if you don't take care of yourself in a certain way, you can't be free enough to and healthy enough to be of service to anything more. So there's still a kind of special responsibility and stewardship for the body mind.
For this body mind that I'm living in right now.
Right.
Yes, absolutely. Now this is great. I mean, and this brings up something, because this is a question a lot of my own students hit. Everybody hits this at a certain point, I would say almost everybody, where they go, it's the moment when they start to realize how big it is what's calling them. They start to go, oh my God, you know, this is the real thing. And it's almost like a tractor beam or whatever in Star Wars, Star Trek, the tractor beam hits you and it starts to pull. You're like, the vacuum is pulling you upward. And they go, oh, wow, you know, they can feel the force of evolution. They can feel the radical call for their unconditional kind of giving over to that and living that much greater life. And then they have this moment where they say, well, but what about my life and my family? And who's going to take care of my kids? And what about my job? And it's an interesting moment, because it's a moment, if you really look at it kind of mythically or classically, It's a moment of a lapse of faith, because, again, what is it that we are wanting to surrender to anyway? The only reason we would ever want to surrender to it, because we believed it was a force of goodness, that it was like that God is good. Therefore, we want to surrender to God because we know God is good and God is wise. And if I, you know, live a holy life, I'm going to be wise and I'm going to be good. And so we're wanting to do that. And so what I always say, of course, I say, well, you know, ye of little faith. I mean, you're sort of saying that you think that if you allow God to take over your life, to speak mythically about it for a moment, if you allow God to take over your life, that God's not going to care about your children, and God's not going to care about your health, and God's not going to care about you, you know, providing for yourself. Well, what good would you be then? You know, it's sort of like, and to ground that, take it out of mythical, what in my experience, what happens is we become much more effective in the world. We become much more able to take care of ourselves, you know, because, again, we're liberated from wrong views. We're liberated from conditioned relationship to fear and desire. So that means, you know, I'm going to prioritize taking care of myself. I'm going to prioritize taking care of all the things I need to take care of so that my life is in order. And because if it's in order, I'll be more free to give myself to this higher calling. if I'm letting my life fall out of order and into a shambles, then, of course, my capacity to give is going to be limited. So you're absolutely right. The attention comes back onto the self in a totally different way, which is stewardship. It's stewardship over this body mind that I have the most sovereignty over. And then, of course, I want to, it's the same stewardship I start to feel for you, though, for everyone else. I start to feel, well, I'm trying to take care of the evolution of this whole thing now, and the things I have the most influence over are the ones I'm going to give the most energy and attention to, starting primarily with, you know, me, because that's the piece I have the most control, but all my relationships, organizations I'm a part of, institutions I'm involved with, people I can influence, you know, it just circles out from there, you know, ultimately to this kind of how can I help evolve this whole project, this whole life project that we're a part of. But yeah, it definitely includes, you know, more than includes the kind of.
Yeah, good. I'm glad you got a chance to really lean in and speak to that, because this, there's a kind of tenderness and care for oneself that is different from the enmeshment. And the entirely positive and compassionate and stewardship relationship that you began to articulate there, I thought really beautifully, is so important to understand. Because if we begin to feel like the evolutionary orientation is one that lifts us up and out and breaks our connection to the embodied feeling human existence and all the things that are ordinarily the domain of the ego's concerns, then it's going to feel as if it's dissociative and splits us. Whereas I think it can be integrative, and that's a profound developmental move. Yeah. And we don't have lots of models for people who've done it and perfected it. And clearly all of us are on the bleeding leading edge of something
yeah.
new coming into being. And that is, sometimes we check the validity of what we're doing by looking, well, who has done this and who shows me a model of how this works? And as we get into this time of rapid evolutionary change, we actually have to operate from a different psychology in which validating our path by verifying it against fully realized and comforting models is no longer really possible, because we're making this thing up as we go along. Mm. Humanity is upgrading the plane while it's in flight. And of course there's a kind of terrifying insecurity in that, and yet it isn't dissociated. There's a tenderness at the core of it. And I think that feeling of connectedness is profoundly comforting in a way that's very important, given that we're stretching so much in our evolutionary moment.
Yeah, no, beautifully. Yeah, absolutely right. And I also just want to say, I know this is particularly can strike a nerve for women who have often culturally been sort of conditioned to self-abandon and be the one who always has to care for others at the expense of themselves. And on their own path, women are often finding, you know, some kind of sovereignty over their self. And, hey, I'm not just going to be, you know, serving everybody. I need to take care of myself. And then they start to discover this evolutionary call that's, again, calling them to kind of radically self-transcend for the sake of a higher cause. And it's sort of like, wait a minute, I was just starting to get on my feet as myself, taking care of myself and putting myself first in ways I need to. And so I always really try to make this point, you know, with a lot of my students are women, and really to make the point that, no, of course, it's not at all about abandoning that, but it is about taking it into a new context where now even your reason for taking care of yourself isn't for yourself. You know, it's for this service to divine evolution, if you will, which then
Beautiful.
Tends to kind of bring it all together. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There's an imperative that even transcends your own life and lends it dignity and meaning and purpose and is itself a source of energy and inspiration rather than
yeah.
a displacement of one's center. It's an actual, there's a kind of hollowness in the center of life until that kind of higher purpose really arrives, and that there is a peace in that that is actually as profound as the peace of being.
Yes.
and therefore a comfort and a source
Absolutely.
Of strength and sanity
Absolutely.
In the midst of the madness.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Beautiful. Well, yeah. this is great. It maybe is a segue into the next part of what I wanted to get into with you, Craig, which is to ask you, okay, so having clarified this view of an evolutionary integral view, an evolutionary enlightenment, what are the kinds of practices that serve it? Is it, since it's a different realization and worldview from that of classical enlightenment, what ways are the practices actually changing? Is it about doing the same practices in a new framework of understanding, or is there a whole new approach to practice itself?
Yeah, both and. It's a fascinating question. Yeah, right, because of course all of the classical practices were developed in a pre-evolutionary worldview and a pre-evolutionary spirituality where we were primarily aiming for the discovery of being, or perhaps, you know, the discovery of non-duality, which was, I wouldn't quite say it was being and becoming, but at least it was a recognition that being included the manifest world in some way. And yet, you know, here we are awakening to a new spiritual impulse, and we're in a new world. And so the question is, well, yeah, do the practices of the past really apply? And if so, how much? And so, yeah, I said both and because I think that meditation practice itself, so traditional practice of non-dual meditation, as was taught in many of the Buddhist schools, certainly in the Zen schools, the higher teachings of Vajrayana or Tibetan Buddhism, of Dzogchen and Mahamudra, all these, this kind of traditional radical non-dual meditation, I don't feel that can be improved upon, really. I mean, those great yogis in the Himalayas and, you know, the mountains of China, and they really got it down. and when it's about awakening, letting go into being or into the non-dual realization itself, then the traditional meditation in that sense, I think, is kind of full and complete and still totally applies. And in fact, in my I teach, as you know, I teach a 9-week long course, but I also teach a year long course for graduates of the introductory course. And I meditate with them virtually. We have a virtual morning meditation 5 days a week, and as a foundational practice for the evolutionary work we're doing all the time. And really, the meditations I'm teaching, they're in some ways in more modern language. I'm not going back to traditional meditation texts to source it. I'm just sourcing it from my own meditative practice. But they're, it's really the same kind of primary meditation that I would say. But you see, where this practice question gets interesting is when we start to look at, A, how different the world is now, but more than that, how different we are now. You see, one thing that is not really widely understood yet is how radically human beings have evolved, even just in the last couple thousand years, even in the last few hundred years, probably even in the last 80 years, that what it's like to be a person now, particularly, and not just any person, but what it's like to be a person at the leading edge, a postmodern or integral person who's kind of at what we might call the leading wave of development of consciousness. What it's like to be you or me is radically different than what it was like to be my parents, who are still alive, but I can tell you, it's a radically different experience they're having than what I'm having of being a self. And compare that to our grandparents, their grandparents, go back. Compare it to what it was like to be a person probably in the Roman period. One thing we know it was like was that even the nice, decent, dignified people, your neighbors, your friends, would go down to the Colosseum to watch people getting torn to pieces by lions for entertainment. Something must have been different about being a person back then, because most of us, you know, certainly all of us on this call, but most of us on the planet now couldn't stomach it. What's happened? we've become much more sensitive. We've cultivated a much more profound sense of interiority, of subjectivity, of sensitivity to the other and their interiority and subjectivity. And so this has also created a possibility for a kind of intimacy that people in the past didn't know. There was no intimacy like we know it now, where you're really seeing me deeply and I'm really seeing you deeply. And there wasn't a self to be seen in that sense historically. This modern sensitive self or individuated self that we have in existence now is kind of a new thing. And so to take that back to the practice question, well, so the question is, what kind of new practices then become possible with this new human that we are? And so there are kind of two main directions I would point to. So one, and that I really focus on in my own work. And so one of these is that now we now have the profoundly evolved capacity for introspection, for self-reflection, to look within and look at our own motivations. When we do something that caused harm, we can stop. And it might take some work, but we can kind of sit down and feel into it and think deeply and go, why did I do that? And we can see, oh, I did that really just out of my own kind of selfish reaction or my anger reaction or some kind of competitiveness I was feeling. We can see it. We can know ourselves in that way. And so a lot of the practices that I teach at Integral Enlightenment are forms of self-inquiry, introspection, reflection, where we're really examining ourselves on an ongoing basis, both sitting down perhaps with a journal, but also in the midst of daily life, in the midst of activity, to be engaging in practices as we're going through our life to both challenge our conditioned ways of being, but also to examine them, to see them clearly, so we can start to cultivate a free choice in the face of them. So that's one part of how practice is changing. But another way is that this whole, because of our newfound interiority and our newfound kind of capacity for intimacy, the possibility now for collective group exploratory spiritual practice has emerged, and there are many people pioneering this in different ways. And in the work I was doing at Enlightened Next for so many years, it was a huge part of our practice, was sitting in various groupings, talking, but not just talking about spiritual things, talking from the higher dimensions of the self, exploring the deeper domains of consciousness and awakening as a group together. So in other words, doing what was traditionally done privately in the interior spaces of oneself, but now doing it more publicly in an exploration between us. And this piece is one of the most profound spiritual innovations of our time. You cannot find this in the traditions as a practice anywhere back there, which I think in some ways validates what I'm saying, because now you see it starting to pop up everywhere in different forms. And when it's directed in the right way and held in an evolutionary context, groups start to have this radical experience very quickly of awakening to a higher self. And the whole collective awakening to the same higher self together, and starting to explore consciousness together from there. And there's this tremendous experience of unity and of really radical collective enlightenment that's starting to come online. And it's one of the things I'm most excited about in my own teaching work is helping groups cultivate this higher we that really is a doorway into the infinite.
Beautiful. Well, you know, Craig, that kind of opens up one of the other questions I really wanted to get into with you, because you're not only pioneering a leading-edge Dharma, but you're pioneering the way spiritual teachings are delivered in the last just year and a half, really, maybe a little more. You founded your Academy for Evolutionaries and have just in a very dramatic way, just become very visible all around the world, and your teaching has reached many thousands of people and encircled the globe in just a short time. So what has it been like to try to teach this authentic spirituality and guide people in real substantive transformation in this virtual format where you don't have the face-to-face contact that's usually so basic to spiritual paths, where Sangha is face-to-face and there's that subtle energetic contact with one another in the same room? What are the challenges and what are the opportunities? What's working? What's challenging? Why have you chosen that form, and how are you feeling about using it ongoing?
Well, you know, it's actually really fascinating because as you said, you know, I'm teaching this, I have created this global virtual classroom in a sense, and have had about 1,600 people take my 9-week course in the last year, and about 250 people now in an advanced year-long training with me, and these are very intensive programs. And when I have to admit, when I started out, I didn't know how it was going to go. When I offered the first class in fall of 2009, I offered it virtually, so it's, you know, there's. It's kind of an online course where students are engaging together in community, engaging with me over the phone and over the internet, and you know, this whole process is happening. And I didn't know if it would. I mean, I knew. I don't want to say I did. I knew it would work to some degree. I just didn't know how far we could go. I really didn't. I thought, well, we'll see what's possible in a virtual context. What I know is that there's a hunger for this, and that there are people who want it around the world, but let's see what we can do together. And so it's been really a grand experiment for me this last kind of year and a half. And I am actually at a place now of amazement and awe that kind of moves me to tears, because I'm seeing this both the collective awakening that I was talking about happening, but I'm also really seeing the radical individual transformation happening through this virtual forum. And, you know, I mean, we put a lot of energy into designing it in such a way that would facilitate the most profound, deep, engaged experience for participants that we could with the technology available. And yet still there was a question at the beginning, but now there's no question. Now I'm just saying, wow, you know, where do we go from here? How much deeper can it go? But there is a profound experience of community happening between people. There's a profound experience of deep spiritual brotherhood and sisterhood and mutual support and connectivity, often for people who live in areas where they don't have much at all, if anything, locally to really plug into that they're resonant with in the way they are with this. And so it's just become an incredible service. Like you said, I think people from 36 countries have participated in the program now and are connected to each other. And I mean, in terms of the challenging part of it, of course, is that you're not seeing people face to face, but ultimately the intimacy that becomes possible, say in discussion phone calls where groups are talking together, some people report that they feel more intimate because there's not all the social clutter. There's not people seeing you and the kind of self-consciousness that comes from sitting with other people, being seen by them, and, you know, the posturing, all the kind of social complexity, that a lot of that's kind of removed. It's not an anonymous forum but in any sense, but it's a little freer, where it's almost like these people, we talk about this kind of almost experience of being one, just one consciousness with these different voices speaking on the phone together. And so for me, there are obviously dimensions you can't replicate from the face-to-face experience, but I'm just exceedingly kind of blown away to see what can be possible in this virtual forum. And in fact, I'm excited to see that you're going to be launching your virtual course very soon, that, you know, we've talked a lot about, and I've been involved in a lot of the design and considerations for that, and really excited to see that, you know, you taking your, you know, critical work with integral spiritual practice and bringing it to this online forum again to create a really a global learning community around these important principles. So we're definitely in a new era of inquiry together. And you know, and it's fascinating to just think, because right now what's needed the most on this planet, we need to come together globally, right? I mean, we need to come together across the borders and start to recognize that we're one humanity. We've got one biosphere, we got one Earth, and we better figure out how to take care of it so we can make it through. We have one economy, really, and at this time that this global classroom, global learning community is emerging, it's just incredibly synchronistic, I guess, perhaps you could say, or incredibly well-timed.
It's been so exciting to see this emerge at the same time that, in what I like to call the meta sangha, this connectedness among different sanghas. I feel a tremendous complementarity between your work and mine. Obviously, there's a grounding in the daily doable spiritual practice that has an integral orientation, which is kind of my emphasis, and this context of an awakening to an integral and evolutionary view, and the activation of this call of evolution that is the core of your work. It's been seeing how you've been able to do this that really seeded my imagination, and it was out of that we've had the conversations that have where your contributions to the course design and the structure have come out. So I hope that that in some ways our works will weave together in service of something bigger than any, you know, I think this is an era in which it's not so much about us as teachers, but about a movement that is finding its own legs and needs to be served in different ways. That there are pieces I can bring to bear that aren't there without my contribution, and that is really what lights my motivation and my sense that in this virtual space, humanity is finding another support and inspiration and point of connection and making that authentic. The pioneering work you've done to help that arrive and seeing where that's succeeded, that's been just a beautiful thing to watch emerge.
Yeah, and I'm excited to have my next Integral Enlightenment course starting April 4th. So you can learn about it at academyforevolutionaries.com. And I know you've got a course starting in a little bit before that, actually. So, and I know you're going to probably tell everybody about it soon. So I won't steal
your thunder. Well, we're quite ready to really give it a proper announcement, but it's I think something will begin to be communicated this week. You know, Craig, we've come to the point here where it's time for others. You and I could talk all day, but I know people have questions, and I want to make sure to have some time for that.
Great.
So the first thing I want to say is please, if you're listening on the webcast, enter any questions you have in the message box on the webcast page. You just refresh your browser and the message box will appear, and then you'll need to click play again to restart the webcast. And if you're called in on the phone, you can press star 2 to raise your hand. And while you're doing that, I want to tell you about a few things, including one of the most interesting and valuable programs that's currently being offered to the evolutionary community, which is called the Integral Incubator. The Incubator is a unique 5-day intensive conducted at Boulder Integral, designed to help you get traction on your dream project or personal calling. Do you have a business idea that you're just not getting to? Or have you been called to do something in the world but can't quite figure out how to make a living at it? Or perhaps you just want to gain clarity as to what the best path is for the next phase of your life. If so, join the Integral Incubator in beautiful Boulder, Colorado, led by another dear friend of mine, entrepreneur and Boulder Integral founder Jeff Salzman. The Integral Incubator presents a proven design for success. You'll work one-on-one and in small groups with Integral coaches who specialize in helping you break through old patterns that keep you stuck. You'll learn powerful strategies for marketing, personal productivity, collaboration. You'll develop an integral, that is, comprehensive approach to your next steps, multiplying your chances for success. And you'll also have an opportunity to work with a guest teacher and world-renowned integral philosopher, Ken Wilber, at a special session at his personal residence. The Integral Incubator is providing liftoff for many talented people, just like you. Upcoming Integral Incubators start March 18th and June 29th. And you can check them out at integralincubator.com. Also, please stay on the line all the way to the end of this call when I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming up with our upcoming guests. There'll be a conversation with Soul of Money author Lynn Twist next Sunday, February 20th, at the same time. And then later, Andrew Harvey, Michael Dowd, Roger Walsh, Candace O'Denver, and A.H. Almas, the founder of the Diamond Heart Work. And then we'll open up the lines at the end so we can hear some of each other's voices as we say goodbye. Okay, let's get back into the question and answer section of today's broadcast. Let's see. We have some raised hands, and let's begin with a question from Tucson, Arizona. I don't know your name. You're on a cell phone, though.
I'm wondering, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. What's your name?
Newtopia.
Hi, Newtopia.
Hey.
Hi. My question is about the evolutionary impulse as it relates to what is happening in the Middle East, and particularly Cairo.
And
yeah.
What is it you're wondering about? Like, you're feeling that there's something very exciting going on there and that it's important, and how exactly is that an expression of the evolutionary impulse? Is that your question?
Yes, and is the evolutionary impulse revolutionary? And if so, how do we make it happen here in the United States?
Okay. Well, here's the thing, I want to make a distinction just for all of our benefit, because, see, there is, I mean, when we look at the impulse of evolution, when we look at the history of the cosmos, if you will, starting back at the Big Bang and extending forward to this moment, we can see this evolutionary arc or this evolutionary thrust unfolding itself first through cosmogenesis and biological evolution, cultural evolution, consciousness evolution, technological evolution, everything I spoke about earlier. We see this thrust. And so we can look at the evolutionary impulse and put it in third person or as an external force. It's this force running through the whole thing. And I think if we look at it in that way, we would see, wow, well, my God, what's just happened in Egypt is it's a major breakthrough for, you know, it's not exactly a breakthrough for cultural evolution per se, because it's not a new structure that's emerged. In other words, it's kind of the breakthrough opening for that particular stuck part of the world to move forward and get caught up to some degree with other parts of the world that have, you know, in this case, we'll just say, maybe to simplify, talking about democracy and saying, well, hey, this is an opportunity for democracy to enter a part of the world that's still a bit stuck in the Middle Ages, in some ways, and move it forward. And my God, what a massive evolutionary advance for that social structure in that part of the world. Definitely. But we wouldn't quite say it was like a new evolutionary emergence, though, because democracy as a structure and what we're hoping will take place there, you know, emerged already, you know, a couple hundred years ago. So I guess that's how I would look at it. What I'm talking about here in terms of the conscious awakening to the evolutionary impulse, I'm talking about the potential for us as human beings to begin to embody it in a radically pure conscious form, where I now become the force of evolution. I now become an agent of evolution on the planet. Now, what happens when I do that? Maybe I get lit up like you, you know, and I say, I want to make social evolution happen in this country, and how the heck can we do it? And when you or me, when one of us wakes up to this enough that we become an unstoppable force for change and transformation and evolution, we go out and make it happen, you know, or we at least do our part, but we just get out there and we ask the questions that need to be asked, and we push and we follow our own kind of deepest passionate callings, because we're all called in different ways. And yes, then by all means, may that and a million other revolutions occur on this planet to help bring about a real evolution and begin to create the heaven on earth that our deepest heart senses is possible.
And it's also worth saying, Newtopia, that there is something inspiring and amazing going on right now in the whole Arab world, and that these changes in Tunisia and Egypt are an inspiration, and they rightly do reflect a call upon our sense that things that seemed impossible in certain pregnant moments open up, and the limitations that have seemed absolutely formidable and impossible to exceed are not. And seeing that and reflecting that this may be a time of transition that is going to really transform the whole Arab world in a way that has both dangers but perhaps wonderful positive opportunities. You know, this is a cause for hope and a cause for courage and a sense of no limit thinking of seeing that there are way more possibilities. Way more positive possibilities available to us than we sometimes think, and I can feel that you've felt stirred by that, and I have too. And I think that aspects of the evolutionary impulse are given strength by this kind of example. So, you know, I'm with you.
Yeah, you know, just also, I mean, the United States for all these years have backed that dictatorship.
You know, well, yeah.
You have a role to play in this.
Right. I can appreciate, but I don't want to get into a political discussion quite so much as a conversation about these topics. But thank you so much for your call, Newtopia. I hope this has been helpful. Take care.
Bye.
Let's take an instant teleseminar question. Lawrence in Santa Fe has a pretty deep question of a somewhat different kind. He says, I've observed that in spiritual circles there's a chauvinism that places primacy on the psyche and denigrates the body or gives minimal or nominal attention to developmental embodiment and conscious incarnation except as an ideal. Why have somatic practices and disciplines been so treated?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'd have to talk to you a little bit, Lawrence, to know precisely who you feel is denigrating which kinds of practices when, because I know, at least in the, and perhaps it's because I travel in integral circles, but certainly I would say in the, one meaning of integral is whole, and therefore one meaning of integral is that we want to transform the whole system, the whole human being. Now, so I feel like among integral people who I'm connected with, there tends to be a respect for a lot of different dimensions of work. My own wife uses a lot of somatic practice in her work, and so does Terry's wife, in fact. And, you know, so Terry and I are both obviously influenced by that in different ways. But I will say something that might speak to what you're asking about, because, see, one question that we encounter when we are on a spiritual path, we think, well, where should I put my attention? Where should I focus my practice? We all have a limited amount of time to practice. We have a limited amount of attention to give to our spiritual practice, unless we renounce the world and do it 24/7. But even then, that's limited time. It's not infinite. And some people, and the thing to recognize is that there are different levels of intervention on the human system, you could say, each person being a system of all kinds of different dimensions and forces. And, you know, we've got our physical system and the energetic system, and we have our consciousness, which is our values, our beliefs, we have our motivations, all these. So the question becomes, well, what would be the most direct for the sincere seeker who's really passionate about this, what would be the most direct path I could possibly follow to bring about the most profound transformation of my whole system? And so some people say, well, we should work at the body level because that's the foundation. If you change things on the somatic or physical, that will change everything up above them. You know, it will then shift the energy. It will change your consciousness. And, of course, then some people say we should work at the energetic level. It's all about energy. Everything is energy. Let's just work energetically, and that will change both the physical system and it will change consciousness, our values, our motivations, our psyche, all these things. I'm definitely in the camp that tends to say that working at what we might call the higher levels has the best chance of transforming the whole system. And I'm not saying it will perfectly, because again, many people who say, for instance, just meditate, do what's been called spiritual bypass, where they kind of can reach higher states, but they're not at all integrated in that. So I'm not saying that automatically works that way, but particularly what I would say is, for instance, I don't know that, say, working on a somatic level is going to change your values or your perspectives or your motivations, which, see, from my understanding of how all this works, that's in the end what really matters. That's the change that can potentially change everything, is when we discover through our own inquiry and our own deep practice, we discover a different reason for being. We discover a whole new perspective on life that awakens in us a passion to be a different person, to live a different kind of life for a higher calling and purpose, which in this case is to participate in the evolution of the whole. You know, in a sense, as a radical sacrifice, I'm going to give my life over to the evolution of the whole. I'm not going to live merely for myself. Come what may, I'm going to go. And that when that kind of awakening happens, that it can potentially revolutionize the whole system. It meaning it will bring about a radical energetic shift for sure. And in my experience, it will also bring to the front, to the fore, all the kind of somatic patterns and stuck points, all of that. It has to get blasted through, if you will. It has to get opened up, clarified, seen deeply, witnessed, released, relinquished. It's like all of that kind of gets driven by the awakening at the level of consciousness and the shift in perspective at the level of consciousness. So, you know, I'm somebody who puts the emphasis, which is probably what you're picking up on, I'm putting the emphasis on consciousness, what you're calling psyche, and saying that that's what's going to revolutionize potentially everything else if we're careful, meaning if we're paying attention to all the different levels. We're not just assuming that's happening. We're in a kind of radical face everything, avoid nothing relationship to our whole human experience as we, you know, probe into these higher domains. But, you know, there are many people out there who would argue with me and say, no, it's the other way around. It's all about the body, and that will change your everything above it. So I just want to articulate the terrain a little and then leave it open for each of us to choose our own path. And, of course, different practices at different times for different folks, that is the nature of the game. So what one practice that might be really powerful for somebody this year might not be next year. And so that's why it's great to have so many different teachers and opportunities to engage out there.
Thanks, Craig. Brad, can you please unmute the line for Sharona Fine?
Hello.
Hi, Sharona.
Hey, hi, Terry, and hi, Craig. And,
hi.
Terry, nice to be with you in this virtual setting again. And Craig, I'll be with you in that domain soon enough. So my question, my reflection on these conversations is, it seems to me that we've reached this edge of evolution through our ability to self-reflect and that growing capacity. And, you know, when I take that to, if that's the micro, when I take that to the macro, it occurs to me that culture is beginning to self-reflect through media such as Facebook, through phone calls like this, and that, you know, that same process that's been happening to us individually is also happening culturally on these just very real technological levels. And I just wondered if you had any comments in that range.
Yes, I think it's starting to happen, and I think it's incredibly exciting. I honestly, what is happening with the internet is something none of us should assume we really have any grasp of yet. I think almost all of us are a few years behind grasping the implications of what's going on, because you're right, this the capacity for collective self-reflection that's occurring and for collective galvanization of a movement around a new emergent need or idea, it's extraordinary. And I'm just ever, because of course, like I mentioned, I've begun to teach courses on the internet at the Academy for Evolutionaries, and I'm always feel I don't even quite get what's happening, and then it'll hit me in a way like, wow, look, people are actually waking up together in this context. It's really happening. It's not just an idea I had that could happen. It's occurring. And I think we look out across the world and what's happening with technology and Facebook and so many different things that are, you know, in many ways it was, people are saying that was very instrumental in what happened in Egypt. You know, the collective self-reflection on Facebook. Wow. What's going to happen next? We have no idea. So
yeah.
It's incredibly exciting.
Head up this leading edge, you know, it's just made,
yeah.
It's magnified it, made it so much more whatever. I'm not sure effective, but yes, effective also. You know, So yes, kudos.
Yeah, exciting times to be alive.
Yes, wonderful.
Thank you.
We have a question in Centella Seminar. Paul from Toronto asks, how is your work different from that of Andrew Cohen?
Well, Andrew was my teacher for 13 years, for anybody who missed the intro, and he is an extraordinary pioneering luminary who's been, you know, I know Terry and I both have tremendous respect for the way he's been pushing the edge of this evolutionary enlightenment for a couple decades now, and often feeling very alone out there at that edge in the face of a lot of resistance and inertia in the kind of contemporary spiritual subculture. In terms of how my own teaching differs from his, I left that community and that body of teaching about 5 years ago with a sense that I was living in a laboratory of evolution that was really a kind of petri dish, if you will, where we were really pushing into new structures in consciousness, particularly around this notion of collective awakening and also around evolutionary awakening as a collective. And yet it was clear to me in that context, I thought, wow, I wonder if any of what we're discovering here in this petri dish has any relevance for what life is like in the outside world, where people have, you know, careers and families and all the obligations of a household or life. And it was out of that petri dish, you know, that I left really with a calling to find out how I could bring all of this to bear on a householder life, on life as it's being lived by all of us out here in the world. And it took me a couple of years to really figure it out. I mean, not that I've really figured it out, but I mean, it took me a couple of years to get oriented out in the world at large. But what began to crystallize was really, it's deeply resonant with everything in Andrew's teachings of evolutionary enlightenment. It's, in some sense, you could say it's just a unique expression of the same fundamental kind of principles and fundamental awakening that really is what Andrew's teaching comes out of. But I've definitely gone some very different directions with it in terms of this whole, some of the piece I was talking about of trying to create a practice and a path of radical evolutionary self-inquiry where I can begin to, you know, use my extraordinary powers of mind and self-reflection to both dismantle the ego structure that's getting in my way, but also not just dismantle that, but to really begin to awaken to and embody this evolutionary impulse, which, as I said, is the change that can change everything, to really wake up to a different part of the self that already pre-exists and that already is a fundamental yes to life. And so, in a sense, the difference between the paths are really about the paths themselves. I've got a lot of different kinds of practices that I've innovated and brought to bear, and also a lot more specific collective practices. So I guess, you know, in many ways, it's just another branch shooting off of that tree, going in a slightly different direction, but still attached to that same trunk, the same deep fundamentals, where Andrew and I are completely aligned. So that's pretty much what I would say.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Craig. We have another live caller. We still have time, I think, for at least one more question. The caller ID identifies the line as Joan Dale in Nantucket, Massachusetts. Welcome.
That's because, hi, this is Melanie. That's because she gave me her old cell phone.
Hi, Melanie. Welcome.
Hi.
Oh, God, I so much appreciate this work. You know, when you talk about how you answered her, Craig, just now, I got pulled into a realm of real life in adoption reunion down here in Miami recently. And what I found was I was so caught in that mentality of crisis and emotional stuff, but these practices, oh my God, have come to my rescue, and I'm so appreciative of you know, knowing this other way. And one of the things is from Jonas Salk's book, he has a whole chapter on universal evolution. And it also came from a poster for Twilight. When you live forever, what do you live for? And there's this shift into purposefulness.
Mm.
And I guess I need to be more quiet and synthesize this stuff. So many things have been coming together. But you've just validated and underlined where my heart is for this. And it is being in the world and of the world. And thank God for the practices that I've just begun to use in recent couple of years. Somebody said once, the mother of all practices is returning to practice. Would you say that's really the meditation is the center of being able to stay centered on this edge of evolution?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I would say that I consider meditation a fundamental practice for all the reasons that we spoke about before, and that meditation in the way that I teach it or in any kind of non-dual meditation approach, it's a fundamental practice of letting go of any identification with anything. So it's a way of letting go of the whole world at once, and having no relationship to anything at all. And so what that does, in my experience, is it actually serves a kind of purifying effect, if you will, on our evolutionary practice. Because awakening to the becoming in the way I spoke about earlier, I think you could hear there's a potential to let go of the world and be swallowed whole by the divine evolutionary impulse itself, and that is in itself a kind of complete path. But it's just very easy for the ego to find a way to jump on board, because it likes becoming also. But the ego can't really survive in pure being if we really go all the way in. It's over, because there's nothing for it to grasp. There's nothing for it to hold on to. And so I feel that having that kind of foundational practice, it's by no means the primary evolutionary practice, and I don't really have time to go into that now because there's so many levels of that, which I teach in my course, but it's by no means the primary evolutionary practice, but it is a foundational practice for any serious enlightenment path, I would say. So,
will there be a point where, like a tipping point, where I won't have this struggle to stay in those higher states
Well,
of worthiness and resourcefulness. I mean, really, it was like getting sucked into some kind of a magnetic force field. And,
right.
And for a few weeks, I thought I was that.
Yeah. Well, honestly, Melanie, there's no simple way. There's no completely easy way out. And anybody who tells you there is, you know, make sure you...
Darn it.
Don't give them your credit card too fast. There is a way out, and it has to do with the cultivation of a real, on the one hand, a deep interest in getting out of that. So where you really can see the pain that's causing to you and others, and the limitation that it's exerting on your potential, and so you have a strong desire to break out of that cycle. But then importantly, you have to undertake a deep self-examination on an ongoing way to start to see those structure of that pattern in yourself, so you can get to a place where the moment it starts to get triggered, you're right there seeing, this is that first step down that slippery slope. I'm about to take that first step. I have a free choice. I'm not going to. And once you get to that level of self-awareness where you know where it starts, because, see, it's harder to, once you step down the slippery slope and you're sliding, it's really hard to stop, which is
no
what you're
kidding.
Talking about. But when you can get to know your own patterns, to know thyself so clearly, the structure of your own ego, how your own tendencies work, to where that you can see right when it starts, then you can say, I'm not going to go this time. I'm not taking that step. And it might take a lot of will power, but we can do it. And when you break that, you start to break the whole cycle. And then you start to discover the sovereignty and empowerment of being a liberated person who no longer is acting in knee-jerk ways in response to your own conditioned past.
Thank you so much, Melanie.
Thank you. Okay.
Almost out of time, but I'd like to give you a chance to maybe make a pith response. Pierre in Bern, Switzerland, is upset with a recent election there. He says the results of this weekend's vote in Switzerland have been yes to a new nuclear power plant, yes for people keeping their army guns at home, highest number of votes for the most conservative candidates for a Senate seat. Feels like being on the wrong planet. Will a new conscience ever become reality under such circumstances? I think that it's not so much the specifics of what he's asking, but there's people often bring questions around this issue of hope when they see these retrogressive forces being so strong and intractable. And I think that's worth responding to.
Yeah. Well, and I'll take a moment to it. And I think the one of the most profound ways to engage your inquiry in the face of what you called sort of retrogressive movements in the world is to step into a deep time context, what's called a deep time context, which is to see it in vast historical perspective. Because, you know, at any given point, at any place on the planet, things might be moving forward or they might be moving back or they might be stuck in one place. And it's always been that way. But where we can start to see the hope and the forward movement is when we get that 30,000-foot view. We start to see, let's look at what life was like a couple thousand years ago. Let's go back, you know, further than that. Let's go back, you know, say 15,000 years ago when everybody was basically you. The only people you were friends with were your little clan, your tiny little clan. Anybody from another clan was a threat, and you would either kill them or run away from them. You know, according to Jared Diamond, anyway. But and a lot of others who've studied what it was like back then. You know, that was how we all were. Now, you know, things have come a long way. There are many of us now who are really trying to create a global village, who really deeply care, want to make a difference, can sense the possibility for an extraordinary unified humanity where we're not just out for ourselves or our family or our clan or our nation or whatever, but we've really come together in a higher way for a higher purpose. Some of us, you know, are even beginning to sense this higher evolutionary possibility. That's a smaller number, but, you know, it used to be there was nobody who thought this way or felt this way. You know, now look at the internet. We can find millions of people who are at least beginning to be passionate about a world-centric perspective, not maybe not a cosmocentric perspective yet, but that's coming online too. So the big picture is that we're moving forward. And so we have to engage the momentary setbacks in any specific context within that larger context. That's what can give us an unlimited source of hope and inspiration, and most importantly, passionate conviction to keep marching and keep pushing ahead. Because that is really what's happening, I would argue. That's the real story here is a story of extraordinary evolution on every level of the cosmos. And let's not forget that that's what we're a part of, and that we're on a road somewhere, and that it's going to take all of us giving everything we can to realize its higher potentials, but we can.
Beautiful. Well, thank you, Craig. Looks like we're getting to where we're out of time, so thank you, everybody, for joining us. I want to make sure that you all know how to reach Craig and find out more about his work. Just go on the web to academyforevolutionaries.com. That's academyforevolutionaries.com.
Yeah, that's where you can learn about my upcoming course that I've mentioned here. If you just want to check out some of my work and writings and things in general, you can also just go to integralenlightenment.com. That has various audios and articles as well. That's integralenlightenment.com. So I guess it's worth mentioning both.
Yeah.
Great.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Terry. This has been great and too short. We could go on all day. But
we really could,
I enjoyed stepping back in, and I want to thank everybody who listened and participated. It was great to connect with you, and I hope to meet you in person someday on this journey. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, there are a couple more websites to mention and some upcoming events. Certainly, if you're invited to visit our blog at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog, and you'll find the downloads of past recordings and our upcoming schedule. And you can also join our Facebook group at beyondawakeningseries.com/Facebook. And if anybody you know might be interested in this series, please invite them to register at the primary web address, beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you want to learn more about my work, please visit integralspiritualpractice.com. And a little more detail about what's coming up. Next Sunday, a week from today, I'll be talking with Lynn Twist, the author of The Soul of Money and co-founder of the Pachamama Alliance, on Changing the Dream, We're All Dreaming Together. On March 6th, I'll be interviewing Andrew Harvey, and then later that month, Michael Dowd, and in April, Roger Walsh and Candace O'Denver, with more to come. So thank you so much for joining Craig and me on the phone today. Let's open up the phone line so that everybody who's on the telephone can hear each other's voices
and say goodbye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone. Thank you.
Hello, bye.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to spend
time with you. My well being contributes to the well being.
Enjoying it.
Thank you.
I love you.
I love you both. Thank you.